Hi everybody, my name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here. It's great to be anywhere. I sat home for 22 months waiting for this, waiting for just to be able to get out and do stuff. And I thought it was going to kick off last August. We had 9 events we were supposed to go to. And we'd get to these events, and they were well-supported, but nobody came. Everybody registered. We'd get the event, 500 people registered, 75 in the room. So that's not what we're having now. People are coming. So this is wonderful. It makes a big difference when you come to these events. My sobriety date's November 20, 1984. I wasn't looking for that morning when Officer Lynn Cambry came out and put that gun pistol back in my head and told me. I was glad he was a police officer, to be honest with you. I wasn't sure until he said, "You're under arrest," you know. My name is Lee. They used to call me Inmate 65713 White Male. And so that's an upgrade. Good to see Dick and Barbara. I told Barbara last night, I'm not going to tell my story today, Barbara. I'm just going to get up and tell all the secrets I know about you. That got her here. James gave a wonderful talk, and I like James' talk, too. And I always have. And it's good to see Belinda. I've heard Belinda one time. She's my friend. She helped us load the truck once. So Belinda's a real worker. That's one thing I've seen here. Boy, this is a fellowship in action this weekend because there are people busy and working and doing. And all the little girls from the Harvest House of Hope, which I love. I love that. And a lot of my sobriety is due to having places like that for me to go to take a big book study or something like that. I love little sober houses and treatment centers and stuff. I met John. On Wednesday nights, going to the recovery house, take my daughter, she was 3, she'd bring her coloring book. John got out of prison, been out of prison 3 days. And he came to me after the meeting and said, "I want to change. I want to be a different guy." So I'm not going to tell John's story, but, you know, I took him across the street to Walmart, got a spiral notebook, and we started. And I sponsored John for a long time, and he helped me. And worked with me, and Dick sponsored John for a long time, and he affected everybody's life he came in touch with. Just a big smile on his face. I remember when he got his teeth. Man, he got those teeth, he started smiling, and he never stopped. And they were so much bigger. I mean, they were just normal size, but he really had some messed up teeth. A lot of us do. You know, I did. I had one broken in half. I thought it was an attribute. And because you know where you can smile at somebody with a half a tooth in the front, and they're not going to smile back, you know. And people begged me until I got that replaced. You know, I thought, well, I don't, why? You know, it didn't even register. I might want to have a full mouth full of teeth, you know. But let me get started with this thing. I spoke here 20-something years ago. We were still doing cassette tapes. I don't know how long ago. We're still doing cassette tapes. And I went over a 90-minute tape on my own talk. It's the only time I've ever done it. That's not going to happen today. I just looked. I see what time it is. We're going to quit. Alcoholics Anonymous has been real good to me. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened in my whole life for me. My life was not going anywhere. I was just a troubled kid that had a lot of trouble and had always had a lot of trouble and always was a lot of trouble. People that knew me ran from me. People that liked me ran from me. And if I was drinking, it was going to be trouble. And it was always trouble. And I loved to steal. I wanted to steal something from everybody. I tried to. I don't know where that came from. It developed over time, I think. But it was the only career I had, so I just did it. I was born in Arkansas. My mom and dad divorced and remarried each other 4 times. And that, you know, that happens in the rooms here. That's not uncommon, really. Joe McSee said Phyllis divorced him once. It wasn't even her turn. And so, you know, I love Amy's story. She was dating a guy, had a child with this guy. And then he said, "I don't like babies," and left. And his brother came over to look at the baby, and she liked him too, you know, and had a baby with him. And he goes, "I never understood why my mother-in-law didn't like me. I gave both of her sons beautiful children." I love AA. I love how we are, you know, because we are that way, you know. Whatever that is, that is. None of that sounds right. You know, she said it wasn't my brother. But I love the way we are. We used to have characters. We used to have characters, man. Charlie, Arkansas Traveler, Buttermilk Smith, Wino Joe. Man, we had people that were just bigger than life. Bob W. from Texas. He was in a Nazi concentration. He was in a Nazi Stalag 13-like situation. Guy escaped. You're sitting at coffee with guys like that, and then they start talking, and you go, "What? You escaped from a Nazi camp? Where, after you got shot down over Germany?" Yeah, we had a guy named Leo in our group, and I was looking at Leo's arm. He had some numbers tattooed across it. And I said, "What is that?" He goes, "Well, I was in Buchenwald before they moved me to Dachau. I was there 5 years." And he forgave the Nazis. I said, "My God, you know, you're not supposed to do that." So anyways, big stuff happens here. My mom and dad were problem people. The book says Warped Lives of Blameless Children. Both of my parents were affected by alcoholism and the relatives in their family. My mother's dad, my father's dad. So anyway, they grew up missing some things, and so they didn't have that. So we had a problem at home. I had a sister that had measles encephalitis when she was very young. She's 2 years older than me and developed brain damage. Somehow she had a high fever and had that high fever for days and days and days. And there was so much, you know, there was my mother was distracted. And so she never took her to the doctor or anything, you know. And so my sister grew up impaired all her life, never had a job. Never, you know, couldn't really learn anything, and couldn't drive a car, stuff like that, which, you know, we take for granted. And she lived that way her whole life. And she looked normal, but she was severely impaired. And back then, you just went to high school. You went to school, you know, same school. So by the time I went to the first grade, she'd already failed 2 years and was back in the first grade. And my mother told me it was my job to take care of my sister. And I loved my sister. And I didn't even know she was impaired. I just said, "My sister, you know." And but then at school, I started realizing these things. Somebody come over and ask me, "What's wrong with your sister?" I'd say, "Nothing, you know." And so denial. Immediately. That's how you handle the situation. You know, I don't want her to be hurt. If she thought she was different, she'd be hurt. So just deny, deny, deny. And when we were a little older, she was real pretty. And she had long hair like Jane, and she just, you know, little boys would tease her and pull her hair and do, you know, say nasty things to her, and then I would fight. And I wasn't a fighting guy. I wasn't a guy that wanted to go out and fight and stuff like that. I was defending my sister. I'm like, "Don't you touch my sister," you know? So one time I chased a guy down and caught him in front of the gym, and I was choking him, and Coach came out and said, "Lee, what'd he do?" He said, "Said something nasty to Glenda." And Coach got him, started choking him, took him to the office. So I had a lot. I mean, these were the right people giving me this terrible guidance. You know, they encouraged it. Because they really got behind me on this. "He's taking care of his sister. Leave him alone." You know? And so I got a lot of kudos from doing bad stuff. But, you know, I just couldn't help myself. I was driven to do these things. So anyway, when I got older, every time I left the house, take your sister with you. And I just got tired of it. I didn't want to take her with me. I wanted something for me. I wanted to go be with my friends. So anyway, we were older. I was, 13. She was 15. And we went to a party, and my sister's sitting over there. And I'm talking to people and laughing, la, 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 la. And then I look over, and my sister's not there. I said, where's she at? I'm looking around for her, And I got to this door at the house, and it was locked. And I could hear something going on in there. And then, I realized that the older boys had gotten my sister and taken her in there. And, man, I was going to tear that door down. There was nothing going to stop me. They opened that door to just get off of my sister. And that year, twice on the bus trying to go to school, guys got me and beat the crap out of me, actually. And that's when I ran away. When I was about 15 years old, I just had all of it I could take. When I was 13, I had two shirts and two pair of pants. And I got a job. I wanted some more clothes, I'd go home at night and try to get those clothes ready for school the next day. And so I got a paper route. A buddy of mine had a paper route, and I got a paper route. And after school, I'd fold those papers up and go out and throw those papers. And, man, I was making money. I pay for my own haircut, And the problem is, most people put an envelope out with the money in it and all this kind of meet me at the street and hand me the money. Every so often, there'd be someone that just couldn't get it together to pay me. And not many, just maybe one or two here and there. And getting paid was a big deal. I wanted to be paid. And I would go to the door, I'd knock, I'd do all this stuff, and just no response and things like that. So one day I was trying to get paid, and I was standing there. I wasn't thinking anything at all. And I said, man, you should pay me. I'm throwing these papers here. And the thought came into my mind. I don't know where it came from. Maybe the door's unlocked. And I just reached over and turned the doorknob, and it just kind of opened by itself. And so I just went in and paid myself. I didn't know anything about burglary or breaking and entering. I'd never heard anything like that. I called it visiting people's homes. And when it was necessary to be paid, I would allow myself to even go around back and come inside the back door and pay myself. And sometimes I paid myself with transistor radios, And so anyway, after I ran away, my grandparents found out where I was at and came and got me, and they adopted me so I could go to school. And so I was living with my grandparents, and I mean, there's two people wholly, completely devoted to me, wanting me to have a great life. And I was kind of already shot. And I was a guy that was looking for something to stop what was ever happening inside of me. I was always a guy looking. Third step prayer talks about a bondage of self. Belinda and I said that just a little while ago together. Thank you, Belinda. And I think I was a guy that was caught in a bondage of self a long time before I ever experienced alcohol. I was always a guy looking for some way to break out of this bondage, whatever this was, this thing inside me. And I was 15. There was a little girl in the neighborhood. I've discovered girls. I had a BB gun. My grandfather got me a BB gun. I love that BB gun. And, I'd go out and shoot that BB gun. I'd fight Germans and fight Japanese in my mind, And that was a big thing back when I was a kid. And so, shoot those pie tins, cans. And then one day I was standing in the yard with that BB gun. I slept with the BB gun. I loved it so much. And there was a little girl pulled up across the street that lived there, and I'd never noticed girls. And I was just at that point, where you're going to start noticing that thing. And she got out of the car, and she had a cheerleader outfit on and pom-poms. And she ran. She ran across the lawn in slow motion. It was just like Man, I'd never seen anything like that. where I dropped that BB gun. No more BB gun now, baby. That BB gun's probably still laying there in the grass. I saw something that was a lot more interesting than a BB gun. And I said, I love her. 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 And she must know that I love her. She must know this. This is important information. She needs to know it. So anyway, she was 3 years older than me, had a car, you know, drove and everything. We were at school. I was in junior high. She was in senior high. And I said, I'll tell her I love her when I see her, you know. And so I couldn't tell her. I could not do it. I discovered that bondage of self. There was something happening to me. What is this? I'm not like this way any other time. I can't even look at her. I mean, I can't look in her direction. I could move one eye just a little bit and kind of see her arm. And so anyway, I said, at the dance, I will cross the dance floor. I will ask her to dance. I'll tell her I love her. I'll kiss her. And she'll probably want to go outside under the bleachers. You know, the bleachers. Bleachers were a big deal. There was magic under the bleachers. I'd seen them after they come out from under those bleachers. And so anyway, I couldn't cross the dance floor, you know, bondage of self. Anyway, one day when my grandparents were gone, a friend of mine came to our home with two bottles of Boone Farm Strawberry Hill. It don't take much. But that was the first time I actually ever really drank. You know, so I knocked down that one bottle I had real fast. Listen to this. 15 years bondage of self. 10 minutes later, that's a cure. I was up on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming my declaration of love for this girl, you know. There was no bondage of self. There was complete deliverance, complete freedom, complete liberty. There was more liberty than necessary. You know, I'd gone, shot way past, you know, what was okay and was going way out there with it. And I just stood up on top of the house screaming, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. You know, she finally came outside. And her parents came outside. Some of the other neighbors came outside. You know, and I just, oh boy, I had an audience. You make the stars shine. You make the sun rise. You know, she just buried her face in her hands like this. And I knew instantly that she wanted me. So I was misreading everything that was happening, you know. But that's what alcohol did for me. It was magic, just magic. I'm going to tell you what, I stand up on that roof. Wasn't a guy with two pairs of pants and two shirts. Wasn't no guy with an impaired sister up there that day. Wasn't no guy with mom and dad that hated each other, won't kill each other. There was just me and freedom and liberty and wholeness. Alcohol did it for me. Man, I had smoke rolling out of my ears and lightning out of my rear. Alcohol was magic. Heard Donna say adding alcohol to her body when she was younger was like taking a match and throwing it in a bucket of gasoline. Whoosh! It's not like that for all of us. It was like that for me. Alcohol did it for me. I knew I was going to drink. I'm going to drink this stuff for the rest of my life. You know? And I was talking to little Logan yesterday. I don't know if she's here. I said, what's your problem anyway, Logan? She goes, I have an allergy. I have an allergy to the body. When I drink alcohol, I have little or no control of the amount of alcohol I drink. I said, well, the answer to that is to don't drink. She goes, yeah, but I have an obsession. I have an obsession of mine. And when I drink alcohol, it's a bad problem. But when I'm not drinking alcohol, I still have alcoholism. It's called an obsessive mind. And I have that. And I'm here to treat that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm young, and I'm glad I got here early. I said, my God, I was 10 years sober before I knew any of that stuff, man. I was just going to AA. I had to hear Joe and Charlie to find out what was wrong with me. You're an alcoholic. I know I'm something, you know. I'm something. I'm sure something. Anyway, the guys I hung out with, they wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink. And we didn't have any money. Got to get some money. How are we going to get some money? Get some money, get some alcohol. They'll buy it for us. We just got to get some money. I said, I know. It's called visiting people's homes. And we're going to visit these people's homes. We'll get some money. So we became the worst thing in the community. Instantly. Bang, you know. Listen to this. 16 years old juvenile court. 17 years old, Tucker Intermediate Reformatory, 19 years old, Cummins Prison. I wasn't raised that way. That's not what my grandparents wanted for me when they adopted me. But man, when I start to drink, when I start drinking, I have no control of the amount of alcohol I take. And when I stop, when I quit forever, I do it again. And I have nothing. And nobody in my family, we didn't know anything about alcoholism. When I got out of prison that first time, I knew I'd never have that problem again. You know, I'm going to had a job. They bought me a car. I was all ready to go. My second day out, I got a pint bottle of Jose Cuervo from somebody that loved me, that was doing me a favor. Man, I started, 2 days later, with the same guys doing the same old things. Two months after that, I was right back in there again. Take the next 10 years of my life, just stick them in the garbage can. Every time I got out of jail, I thought I was free. Every time I got out, I said, I'm never going back. Never. I just want to be a regular guy. And I really had, there was things I wanted. I wanted to have a job. I wanted to have a car. I wanted to have clothes. And I wanted to live somewhere. Those were my dreams. And I couldn't do it. I never, never did it. I'd take a drink. Whew, man. I spent my first 8 hours of sobriety in handcuffs. November 1984, I'd taken a geographical. I was in Little Rock. Somehow, we didn't have cell phones. I don't know how they got the word. But the Little Rock PD, Officer Mark Stafford down there, told somebody that told somebody that told somebody if I'd come down and confess to everything I'd done, they would clear the books on all those incidents and not charge me of anything, and I could leave the state of Arkansas and never come back. It's a good deal. Because I always knew that I'd go back. And so I went down and confessed to 86 burglaries and some other stuff. And left Arkansas and came to Florida. And in the next 10 months, I committed 135 armed felonies. And Florida, if you have a gun, it's an armed felony. They don't mean you pulled a gun on somebody, although I have done that. So in November 1984, they threw the net over me in Florida. Last 3 years of my drinking, I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here at all. I can't tell you how many times emergency vehicles came out. I have a hazy, hazy, hazy memory of flashing blue lights or red lights. Somebody picking me up off the ground. And taking me somewhere. You know, man, I'd come to someplace. I look down. I don't have handcuffs on. They can't keep me here. And take me to that nurse's station, try to get my name or something about me. And I'd say, I want out of here right now. Walk straight out the door. Go straight to a drink of alcohol. Last 3 years of my drinking, I took a drink. Alcohol is a progressive illness. You know, the way it was at 15 was the way it was, you know. And then the way it was when I was 30 years old, it was a whole lot different, man. Last 3 years of my drinking, I'd come to in the mornings, my first thought was get the money, get loaded, get loaded, 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 get the money, get loaded, get loaded. That's the only thing my mind could produce. And that's how I lived. And I'd crawl out from under that hole I was in. Out of that cave, that dark tunnel. And I'd go commit crime. So anyway, I was arrested, placed in Seminole County Jail, charged in front of 5 judges. Very often you come here, Alcoholics Anonymous, unwanted, unwelcome anywhere. I want you to know I was not unwanted. I was wanted. And they'd take me out and ram me on more charges each and every day. And one of my sentencing judges, Stroker, looked over at me and told me I was, screamed at me, that I was despicable. I didn't even know what it meant. And I got a dictionary and it said, worthy of being despised. You know, he didn't have to. I knew that. Nobody hated me more than me. I couldn't stand me. I couldn't stand another second of me. You know, alcohol was the only thing that would shut that down. Just almost. Anyway, I'm sitting in jail and, you know, of course, the allergy is not affecting me because there's no alcohol. But I still got this. The book says our main problem centers in our mind. And boy, I got one of those kind of minds. And here's how the obsession acts itself out to me, in me in jail. I'm sitting there. It's quiet, kind of. It's never quiet, but it's nobody's trying to kill each other. And everything's okay. And I'll look over and I'll see somebody. And then I will use my magical superpowers that I have, and I will read their mind. And then I'll tell the future. I say, that person wants to hurt me. That's a bad person. They want to hurt me. They're going to hurt me. What am I? Who am I? Am I going to sit here and wait for them to come over here and hurt me? No. I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to hurt them, and because I know they're going to hurt me. And boy, I went locked down 7 times real fast, and spending all my time in the hole because I couldn't sit among people in population because I was crazy. And so one day I was standing in a jail cell, and out of nowhere I heard a guy say, AA meeting. And my first thought was, why would they have one of those here? You know, completely clueless. Man came to a jail. That's how I got here this morning. A guy named Jerry W. Vietnam vet. That's why I go to the VAs. That's why we keep those camo big books back there for those guys. Jerry had never been in jail. Jerry's just a guy that wanted to help alcoholics. Wanted to take a meeting, men or women that couldn't go and get a meeting for themselves. Jerry had really embraced that idea that Bill Wilson gave us. We don't help other alcoholics because they're alcoholics. We help other alcoholics because we're alcoholics. And Jerry had come to help himself. Man, I didn't know anything about anything like that. I just somebody told me, go to that AA meeting. And I went. And I didn't see nothing there for me. Oh, yeah. I saw that they wrote my name down. And when I go before that judge, I'm going to have that piece of paper. And it's going to say, I attended these AA meetings. Look at this, judge. I'm somebody trying to do something for myself, you know. And that's all I can see that you were worth to me. It's worth getting your name on a piece of paper for a judge. But what happened is November 1984, I stumbled into a room. For 1 hour a week, they called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a whole brand new life. More than I could have ever dreamed or hoped or imagined could ever happen for me. And one night, Jerry came in the meeting, had a big box. He said, these are big books. And my group has donated these, and I brought these big books in here. There's enough for every one of you men to have a big book. And I said, big book? God, man, don't they have a little book? You want to start us off with that big one? You know, man, it'll start you off with a little book, you know. And I said, I don't want one of those big books. You'll never get me to read that big book. And then he said, they're free. I was first one over there. Give me that big book. That's a pretty big book. That's probably worth some money. Can't get two of those big books. And so I had my big book. And then I'd read somebody's mind, imagine some kind of something. They took me back the 7th time. Took me back, put me in a hole. This time I said, wait a minute. I'm taking my book with me because I'm in the program. All the guys in AA put their head down and said, oh, God, don't tell them you're in AA. Nobody will come to AA if they think you're in AA. You're the worst example of AA possible. There could be nothing worse than you ever. Don't tell them. So I stripped me down to my underwear, took me down there, put me in the hole, bang, shut that door. And then I could scream. I could scream all I wanted to scream. And I screamed. Because the only thing left in my brain and in my life was this. And this telling me what it thought of me. And reminded me of every nasty, rotten failure I'd had in my life. Every sorry thing I'd ever done. Every mistake. The people I loved the most that I hurt the most. And it never shut up. And, you know, our book says a dark past, the greatest possession we have, is key to life and happiness of others. We share some crazy stuff here with each other in Alcoholics Anonymous that we would never share anywhere else. And that, I mean, what the worst things in my life have value here because it can help somebody else. That's what I'm going to share what I'm about to share. I was 30 years old. I'm in lockdown. I'm in the hole. And I deserve to be there, and I'm screaming out loud because I can't stop thinking about stuff. Like when I was 27, I'd gotten out of prison. My mother allowed me to live with her. My sister was living there. And my sister, she would become violent. She was big. She was grown. She was older then. And she would get upset and be upset, and she'd start being rough with my mother. And what's necessary is for to go in and mildly restrain her and calm her down, talk to her. And I'd done it all my life. I knew what was required. My mother said, Lee, come and help, come and help. Glenda's being violent. Come and help. You know, I'm going to walk through the kitchen. I'm going to get out of bed at 5 in the afternoon. I'm going to walk through the kitchen. I'm going to go in the living room where my mother is struggling with my sister. And I'm going to take her hand. And I'm going to start laughing. And my sister's going to start laughing. That's all I had to do. My sister loved me. You know, I was better at it than anybody. But when I heard my mother yelling for me, I rolled up, walked in the kitchen. I saw something that nobody ever did around a guy like me. Instead of my mother had struggling with my sister, my mother dropped her purse into a chair. And when I saw that purse, that drink thing hit me. And instead of helping my mother, I took $20 out of her purse and her car keys. And I drove off and I got drunk. Drunk, drunk, drunk. Drunk is $20 it gets you. And when I stumbled back into that place at midnight, I came through the front door and the couch, the floor, the walls, everything's covered with blood. Where my sister had gotten a pistol and shot my mother in the face. I was not there 10 minutes when one of my uncles and my grandfather came through the door and said, Lee, they've stabilized your mother. She's going to live. Come on, let's go to the hospital. Now listen. It was 2 days before they could take me to the hospital. Because I kept drinking. Because when I had alcohol to my body, I have no control over the amount of alcohol I drink. Step one, I drink until I have to get sober. Dash. I stay sober until I have to get drunk. Step one, I can't live with alcohol. Dash. I can't live without alcohol. Step one, my life doesn't work with alcohol. Dash. My life does not work without alcohol. Step one, I can't drink, dash, I can't not drink. I can't drink, 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 I can't not drink. That's alcoholism. That's what I have. Anyway, I'm screaming as loud as I can scream because I can't live with stuff like that. And I have a book. And I'm not a big reader. The guys I hung out with, we didn't hang out at libraries. But I tried to read this book. And I was just stumbling through the book reading, and I found two paragraphs in chapter 3 about a jaywalker. You'd think, why would Bill Wilson put that silly, comical stuff like that in our text? He did that for guys like me. Because, boy, that met me right where I was at. I could see myself all over that story. And it continued to read where it says, When if you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or when drinking, you have little or no control. You're probably an alcoholic. I said, I'm an alcoholic. Am I an alcoholic? I'm an alcoholic. Am I an alcoholic? Am I an alcoholic? Am I an alcoholic? Anyway, in one of the meetings, they played a cassette tape of an AA talk, Jerry. And I responded to that. I became very emotional, something in that talk. And out of nowhere, and this is against the rules, I was a big management problem in jail. You might, you know, they'd done anything to try to calm me down. And I, one of the guards, somebody in AA talked that guard into bringing me that battery-powered cassette player and that tape. And for the next 7 days, I just listened to that tape over and over and over and over again. Man, I was back there going, why can't I die? 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 Why can't I just die? And I'd listen to that tape, and it was a little girl, she just got out, who'd always wanted to die. Her name was June Cheek. And she wanted to die all her life. And at that time, she had just graduated from college and was about to start law school. And I thought, wait a minute. I thought I was the only one. I'm the only one. There's nothing in this world like me. There's nothing like me anywhere. I'm it. There's nothing else like me. And here you go, what? She's just like me. I'm not the only one. And she, I said, AA can do that? AA, it's just not drinking. It's get a life. I said, man, I want a life. I always wanted a life. And so I said, okay. And when they let me out of the hole that time, we had a meeting. I ran up to old Jerry that brought the meetings in and just said, Jerry, please tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. And Jerry said, Lee, I can't tell you what to do, but let me show you what I did. You know, it's all laid out. It's easy for us. He said, pointed me back to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, we had a program. We got a program. Lee, what we're going to do here, if your problem is drinking and drugging and all that stuff you've been doing, stop it. Stop it right now. But if you're like us, you stop and you do it again. And you stop and you do it again. You stop and you do it again. Stop and you do it again. That's your whole life. Here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't call that alcohol problem. We call that, our problem is called powerlessness. And that means you're going to have to find a power greater than yourself. He said, and that's what we do in this program. It's a process called house cleaning. We're going to identify and with God's help decrease, eliminate those things in you that are blocking you. Four times in our text, it says we're going to get rid of it. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to get rid of it. You're on a hot air balloon. You want to go higher. What do? Get rid of something. Go higher. A statue of a woman, long flowing gown, beautiful statue. Asked the sculptor, how'd you do that? He goes, I got rid of what was ugly. And this is what was left. That's what we're going to do in this house cleaning process. We're going to get rid of who you aren't, who you never were. And then what's left is going to be what God put you here to be in the first place. And I said, let's do this. Let's do it. I can do this. I can do this. And so we did third step prayer and started writing four step. And that four step is not a list of who you are. It's a list of who you aren't. That's what we're going to get rid of. And after I did all that, we did a fifth step. I went in a jail, went in a cell with a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous. I told him everything. A lot of AA clubhouses, there'll be a big sign. I love the sign. You're not alone anymore. Oh, how true, how true. But it's only half true. Because until we reveal ourselves to the minds and hearts of another person, we are alone. And what we have in here in Alcoholics Anonymous is a chance to be with one person like I did in jail. And told them everything. Anyway, I stood before the judge, and I got my first few years of sobriety in Florida State Penitentiary. They call it The Rock. And I got there, they had Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew in effectiveness and understanding. I didn't have all the trouble I'd had the other times I was locked up. I never went, that was my last time to be in confinement. When I walked out of there and did that third step, it's just enough God not to be completely crazy. Never went back to hole again. Spent all that time in prison, 2 years, and had one DR for leaving my jacket out one night. you know, model inmate all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous made me a model inmate. Hey, it's a start. You got to start somewhere. So anyway, the day I got out, two guys from Alcoholics Anonymous came and picked me up, Oscar and John. I walked through it. I walked out, and immediately I realized I had prison written across my forehead. I was scared to death. Went to a meeting. Sat there, about 15 people in a circle. Everybody shared. And I said, when it's my turn, I won't tell them I just got out of prison. And it was my turn to share. I said, I just got out of jail, you know. You didn't care where I'd been or what I'd done. All you cared about was what I was willing to do about my recovery and how he could help me. And that's all I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Fall 1986, started the 1201 group in Sanford, Florida. Started walking to those meetings, It was in a halfway house. Walking to those meetings. And a good AA members, it seemed they're always very encouraging. I'd be walking to the meeting, and guy'd drive by and wave at me and honk, hey! You know. I said, hi! You know, you're walking along. Get to the meeting. I had 11 jobs the first 18 months I was out. I wasn't any better that sober than I was drunk. Every job I had had one thing wrong with it. They wanted me to work. Work fascinated me. I could watch it for hours. I'd always heard, hard work will never kill you. My thinking was, why take a chance, you know? So I knew all about work. The penitentiary, the day you get there, they give you a job you don't want that you can't quit. They were serious about that work thing. Got a guy with a gun standing there, make sure you do it. Half a day to those guys is 12 hours. So I knew, you know, I knew about work. And the guy with that gun turns around, you stop. So, you know, I was having a difficult time of employment. And I was a little embarrassed about this, you know. And I was at the meeting, and there was women in the meetings. And I'd be talking to a lady standing there. Well, I wouldn't talk. I'd just stand in front of them, and they would talk to me. And it would be so uncomfortable that they'd start talking. And I'd just listen. And I was standing in front of a woman one night, and away on the other side of the room, I heard, old-timer, have you got a job? No. Get a job. Can't stay sober without a job. I said, okay. And after the meeting, a guy came over, handed me a business card and said, they need some people at this place. A friend of mine, he runs this place. I'll put in a good word for you. Call in tomorrow. So the next day I called the guy up. He said, yeah, we need some people immediately. Come down here tomorrow. Bring your resume. Click. I said, resume? What am I going to put on a resume? State prison. I said, I'm not going down there. Forget it. And so I was walking to the meeting that night. And I got close to the meeting, 1201. It's hot in Florida. It's hot that day. And there were people standing outside the meeting, outside, out of the air conditioning. And I walked up and I was looking. And I saw it was that girl that I was talking to. And it was my sponsor. And it was that old-timer that was ugly to me. And it was a guy that gave me a business card and some other people like me. They said, Lee, did you call? What'd they say? We want to know. Did you get the job? We've been praying for you to get the job, you know. I said, no, I called. It's big. I'm not going down there. That's ridiculous. I'm not going down there. I said, well, and I was talking to that girl. She goes, why not? I said, well, they want a resume. She goes, oh, that's just the truth. They just want you to go down there and tell the truth. I said, I'm not going down there and tell those people the truth about me. The truth about me is horrible. The truth about me is bad. There's nothing good about me. Everything about me is wrong and bad and horrible. And I'm not going to tell that guy that stuff. She goes, ha, ha, ha. That's unwillingness. I said, unwillingness? She goes, yeah. She turned around and told somebody, Lee's unwilling. Took about 30 seconds. There were 25 people there. Went all the way around the room. Lee's unwilling. Willingness is essential. Willingness is the key. Oh, my God, and he was doing so good. You know, now he's unwilling. And my sponsor's standing there. He goes, and he won't tell the truth. I said, okay, I'll go down to this place. I'll go there. Oh, my God. So the next day I got up and went down to this guy's office. He was there. He was really busy. He had a phone in his hand, hung him up. He says, where's your resume? I said, I don't have a resume. He goes, well, no big deal. Tell me, do you have any experience in sales? And I thought, It was like a light went off in my mind. I said, well, yeah, I've sold microwaves and stereos and appliances and guns and boats and jewelry, cars, anything off somebody's porch. He goes, wow, you got a lot of experience. Can you start tomorrow? I said, yeah, man. I sold that guy's product like popcorn. You didn't have to sneak down the alley with it or hide it under a blanket or keep it covered up. You could walk up to anybody. You didn't have to be careful. And I said, man, you know, my whole life took off. And I don't think God minds it at all that we have a little something to do pretty good here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't really think I deserved anything. You know what? God doesn't feel that way. When God looks at you, He don't see all that stuff that we can't forget or won't release. God only sees our potential and what He can do with us if we'll just surrender our lives to Him. God is always working. When I don't see God working, God is working. When I don't feel God is working, God is working. He never stops. Listen to this. 6 months out of prison, all my dreams were fulfilled. Listen, I had a job, I had a car, I had clothes, and I lived somewhere. Now, here's what Alcoholics Anonymous did. I've never lost those things. I've never lost them. Alcoholics Anonymous held me together and put me together in a way that I could continue doing the things that I needed to do to have a life, to live like everybody else. I became a regular guy. That's all I ever wanted. God, can you make me a regular guy? Can you make me a regular guy like my cousins? Yeah. And you know, once you get good at it, and it gets bigger and bigger, but you get so much stuff, it becomes a burden. You got so much stuff. So anyway, I got out. You know, I got sentenced to prison. I got sentenced 20 hours, 500 hours community service, $37,000 in fines, 500 hours community service, 2 years house arrest, and I went to see Mr. Goody, my parole officer. He goes, I got you for the next 20 years. You owe me $37,000. I want to know how you're going to take care of that right now. How are you going to pay it? I said, how about that? He goes, when you come back here next month, I want to hear a plan of how you're going to take care of every penny of that money you owe me. I said, okay. I went back to the group. Man, I was scared to death. I said, what am I going to do? This is a horrible burden on my life. I don't know what to do. And I said, well, nothing I can do about it today. They told me here in AA, I can only do what I can do today. So what can I do today? Well, what am I missing today? Well, I'm not missing anything. Today I'm in the halfway house. I got a place to live. I got a meal. They're going to feed me. I got some clothes. I got a job. I'm going to work. I'm going to AA later. I know people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can pick up the phone call right now. I got everything I need today to make it today. I'm going to do one day at a time. And so the next day I got up and said, what do I need today? I got a job. I got some clothes. I got a meal. I'm living in the halfway house. I got everything I need today. I got people in Alcoholics Anonymous around me. I implemented one day at a time for the next 30 days. Went to see Mr. Goody. He goes, I got your order back from the court. It doesn't say anything at all about $37,000. It says $3,700. This is a big mistake. Till I get this straightened out, just pay $30 a month. I went to my meeting that night and I said, $30 a month, $30 a month, $30 a month. Old timer, you know how they are. You can't live with this hanging over your head. You got to go talk to that judge. You got to get this straight right now. So I said, oh my God, they want me to go talk to the judge. And then it's going to be $37,000 again. I called Judge Southie, most hated and feared judge in our county. Big billboards all over town. Impeach him, impeach him. They hated him. He said, yeah, I want to see you. Come on down here. I went down there and said, Judge Southie, I got my order back from the court. And, you know, you only gave me 2 years. And then you gave me 4.5 years. I pulled 2 on that. And then you gave me all these fines and stuff. And the order I got back doesn't reflect what I agreed to. And I just want to be honest with you about it. He goes, let me see that. I said, it doesn't say anything at all about that 500 hours community service. He goes, what? He goes, you still going to those meetings? I said, yeah. He goes, well, that'll do for that. I said, but the big problem is the fine. You sent me $37,000 in fines, and that only says $3,700. He goes, what? Let me see that. That's a clerk's error. They've left a zero off. Oh, forget about it. Man, I walked back to the halfway house. I was pinching myself. Am I awake? Am I awake? Am I dreaming? Maybe it might be a nightmare. I might wake up in a minute. I got back to the halfway house. I took the big book and set it in the coffee table right in the middle of the day room. I said, ooh, man. Oh, boy, you got to be careful with this program. This is a powerful program. My God, I better really be careful with this. Anybody messes with me, I'm just going to show them this book. You know? Roy was my sponsor, and Roy was a guy that God knew what he was doing when he put me with Roy. And how long have I, what does it look like?
You're at 50.
Okay, good. 10 more minutes. Roy was a guy. Gotten out of penitentiary. Roy had committed a horrible crime. He went down for a second-degree murder charge and got out and started drinking. And he said, I'm not going to stay out of prison at all if I keep drinking. So Roy went down to Central Group and hooked up Bill O. And Bill O took Roy through the steps. Now, Roy was a guy, because of all the beatings he'd experienced in his childhood, he would jerk. His body would move involuntarily. And Roy came to Alcoholics Anonymous and did the steps with Bill O. And after Roy went through the steps with Bill, not only did Roy never drink again, but the power of God through those 12 steps freed him from twisting and jerking so that he could sit in a meeting and be still. And so when I asked Roy to help me, I asked a man that had had a profound experience with the 12 steps. And he knew exactly what could happen in my life if I would do these things. And so we just got busy. Boom, you know. And I wanted to report to you that I had a profound experience. And I'd done as much of the step work as I could while incarcerated, but I'd never done it and really done an I-step at all. So we went through the first part of the book and did all that. And just thoroughly honest. And good things started happening in my life. And then I started on that knife step. Man, I'm a guy that did a lot of stuff. And, you know, I made amends where I could around the community there and forward. But I need to go back to Little Rock and start trying to make some amends there. And I'd go and visit my family. And every time I'd go out and try to do something, you know. Go to some place I'd rented and never paid them the rent, you know. Destroyed their furniture. And try to give them some money, you know, pay them and stuff. Go back to places, give me a job. It lasts about 3 days. I'd steal everything they had there. And just a terrible employee. God. God help them if they ever gave me the keys to one of their vehicles. You know, I've totaled out somebody's car, ran into a city bus, you know, big mess, getting a case of beer. I couldn't go to work that day, boy. I'd go to the liquor store in their car. But I was going around town trying to make amends and stuff. And so I drove by the police department. And I said, oh, they're on the list. I almost forgot. I better go over there and talk to those guys. I was a real mess. I walked in the police department there in Little Rock. And said, my name's Lee. Blah, blah, blah. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to hate you guys. I caused you a lot of trouble. I was a big mess. And I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if there's anything I ever do for you, I'd do it. I'd help you. I see you completely differently. I thank God for you guys and what you do and how you help everybody. He goes, what did you say your name was? He goes, we have a warrant for your arrest. I said, I hadn't been here in 9 years and 11 months. He goes, this warrant is 10 years old. I'm going to call this officer Mark Stafford. He called up Mark Stafford. And he goes, he wants to talk to you. Hand the phone to me. He goes, yeah, we know all about you. People have called and told us you went to that person's home and they wouldn't open the door just a little bit just for you to push that money through and shut that door real fast. And going to places you used to work. We know what you've been doing. And you're a different guy. I want you to know tomorrow I'll go before a judge to have that warrant dropped. I call that guy the next day to make sure they drop that warrant. You know, you call that judge, you know. And so God was moving in front of me trying to help me clean up my life. And, you know, one time I was in a meeting and a little girl was sharing. I'm a nurse. I love being a nurse. God put me on earth to be a nurse. And every day I wake up and I help people. I help people. And sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm so excited. I can't wait to get up and go to work. I just lay in bed thinking about going to work, going to work, going to work. And I said, I was praying about it. I said, God, what'd you put me? Did you put me here for something? Maybe there's something for me. Maybe you had a plan for me. I mean, if there's something like that for me, please help me, move me in that direction, please. 11 months later, I hooked up a guy named Bob P. from Tifton, Georgia, that started taking me all over the country, doing what I've been doing for the last 28 years. I had no trade. I had no skill. I was trying to go to college, you know, and I had to take a bunch of high school courses first and then I started college classes and all that stuff. But, you know, I was trying to, really what it was a career, some kind of job. Teach me something. I didn't know that guy was teaching me something, you know, and I liked it. I did it for nothing. He didn't pay me a nickel. I thought, oh, thank you, Bob. Thank you. You know, I just drive around and go to events. And over that next year, I learned how to do what I, you know. And sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm so excited to get up and come do what I get to do with you guys that I just lay there and I can't go back to sleep. I think about going to work, going to work, going to work, helping alcoholics, helping alcoholics. And it's been the greatest, greatest, greatest blessing. The greatest blessing in my life, of course, my little daughter, Hannah. And, you know, 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system. You think, God, do you really know what you're doing? This is a little girl, you know? And I ended up being a single parent and all that kind of stuff. When she was 3 years old, every Wednesday we'd go to the zoo, you know. And when she was 4 years old, she knew about princesses. So we started going to Disney. We live right there in Orlando. We went to Disney 42 times that year. That's the best year of my life. Then she started school, and she's gone, you know, most of the day. And I just endured. I said, one day she'll be out of school. And, of course, she ended up going to TCU and got a great education. She lives in Fort Worth, married, 21 years old, her and her husband both. They bought a house when they were 21. I mean, something wrong with those kids. They're way too responsible, you know. On the weekends, she volunteers at a refuge for animals. But what it is lions and tigers and panthers and all kinds of stuff. People, they buy these exotic animals. And then they just kind of, oh, well, I've lost interest in this exotic animal I spent $10,000 for. And so they take them and put them in that refuge there in Fort Worth. And she goes out there on the weekends and cuts up cows and feeds those things. I said, man, I hope she doesn't put her arm in there. So, you know, she's got a great life. She grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got a tape of Ray O.K. where he just starts talking. And my name's Ray, I'm an alcoholic. And then you hear screaming. Ah! Her from her stroller. That's my favorite tape. Hearing her scream. Anyway, I don't think there's anything that you can get out of this deal that I hadn't gotten. God wasn't nearly as mad with me as I thought He was. I think God just loved me and wanted me to have more and do more and be more. And I don't think He wants anything less for any one of us. I think He wants that for all of us. I was watching TV one day, used car dealer. You know how they are. Have I got a deal for you? Drag it in, tow it in, push it in, pull it in, get it down here. We're going to give you something more than it's worth. I said, boy, that sounds a whole lot like Alcoholics Anonymous. Bring us your shame. Bring us your guilt. Bring us your failure. Bring us your loss. Bring us your broken heart. Bring us your broken dreams. Bring us your broken life. Because we're going to give you something more than it's worth. Sobriety. More than the simple elimination of alcohol. Wholeness, soundness, renewal. A new life. You know what you get when you cleaned up the past? Today. The freedom to enjoy and experience the present. Right where you are. Right where God is. And where God lives, there's no time. It's just right now. Always. And God don't wait because it's always right now. And we just need to spend more time trying to be where God's at. Sit, be quiet, shut your eyes. And just empty your mind. And be with God. You know, He loves that. I was laying on the couch once. My daughter was about 3. And I was watching TV. And she came over to me. And little tiny thing. She picked my big arm up. And got under my arm. And then pulled it back down around her. Because she wanted to be that close to me. And I was filled with joy. Just filled with joy and love. I said, my God, I didn't know I could love this much. I didn't know I could love this way. And I thought, God, is that how you feel about me? Is that the way you see me? The way I see this baby? Do you love to be with me as much as she loves to be with me? As much as I love her to be with me? Do you feel that way when I spend time with you? I think that's possible. Everything in my life points to the evidence of that. That's how God feels. Now, I want more of that. I want that for you. I want that for you. I want you to just open your heart. Completely this weekend. You're going to hear some great things. You hear some great things tonight. You're going to hear some great things tomorrow morning. You're going to hear great things Saturday. And you're going to hear great things Sunday. Great events. Great things. I'm going to close with a story that John Hunter told me. If I ever stopped telling it, he was going to start telling it. It's a true story. I saw it on TV. 1989, a father walked his son to school in Armenia. And that day in Armenia, they had an earthquake. And they don't build buildings in Armenia the way they build them in Los Angeles. They build it on rock and stone and brick. And the city was just destroyed during that earthquake. And the father miraculously drug himself out of the building he was in and started running where that school was. And when he got the steps to school, it was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and started throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name, Armand, 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 Armand. And people would come to him and say, you're bleeding. Let us bandage you. Let us help you. He'd say, help me find my son. Help me find my son. And they'd say, he's delirious. He's out of his mind. We can't help him. And they'd go help somebody else. 36 hours later, he was still there screaming and yelling out his son's name and throwing rocks and bricks. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, Armand, is it you? He heard, yes, Father, it's me. He said, son, are you all right? He heard, yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he saves me. And after he helps me, he's going to help you too. I want all of you to know, especially you new people, here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father. In the 5th chapter of this book, Bill Wilson wrote, he is the father. We are His children. In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, your Heavenly Father will never let you down. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a Heavenly Spiritual Father who will not rest until He saves you. He will not rest until He reaches you. And after He helps you, He's going to use you to help somebody else. I love you guys. Thank you for helping me stay sober today.
Yeah.